So basically, the X-rated Swatch got you into the watch industry. But, like, how did that, I guess, translate from Swatch to kind of, like, the higher-end stuff? Because you kind of, like, navigated back and forth, I think, between the Swatch store downtown and then the Swatch store kind of, like, I think in the Cambridge area, right?
Yeah, you know, like, basically what happened was, you know, he offered me a job, and I needed a job, so it was, like, the perfect thing. I also remember the day that I actually met you, because I had to go to the other store and get an interview, and I walked in, and I just remember you being, like, a complete jerk to me when I walked in.
That's awesome. I did my job.
Yeah. So I went in, and I got the interview, and then I was working at the Pru for a while, and then they transferred me over to the other store, which, you know, you had moved across the hall and you were working in the watch store. And then I was managing the Swatch store at the same time. And then after managing the Swatch store for a little while, they offered me the service position.
Wow. And that's where, like, all the chicks would come to see you, I remember. I was so jealous.
Yeah, you know, like, I basically, you know, I had a pretty good life for a while there. You know, I would just sit there and people would just come visit me, and I would just sit at my little desk in the back of the store and be like, hey, what's going on?
And that's where you could kind of be a dick, too. Like, people, you were the king of the dicks, I remember. Like, people would come up to you, and you just answer in one-word answers, and they'd be like, you're so cool!
You know, it's weird because, like, you know, being kind of a nerdy, like, outcast punk rock kid all your life, and then people coming up to you and fawning over you, I didn't really know how to take it. So I would just, like, I would just answer in short answers and hope, like, they wouldn't, like, you know, because it was really uncomfortable for me.
Yeah, for all of those of you who don't know Brian or don't know what he looks like, he kind of looks like a hardcore Buddy Holly looking dude. So, like, from there, take me through it. Like, what did you, like, working in the service department and stuff, did you, like, find that it gave you a different perspective of the watch business? Or were you kind of like, did it make you hate it? Did it make you like it more? Did it make you want to, like, delve into it, like, certain brands or what?
Well, I think that first and foremost, coming from Swatch, which, you know, working at Swatch was great and working with Swatch was great, but Swatch collectors, as you know, like, they're so petty over a $40 watch. And then, like, going from that and then going into the service industry, like, when someone hands you, like, a $10,000 watch and it's not working properly, and they just appreciate you because you're going to make sure that their watch works properly, it was, like, a totally different world. And it was also, like, every day in the service department was an education for me because I really didn't know anything, but I could make phone calls and I knew how to use a computer and I can keep stuff in order. So that was basically why I got the job. And I basically had to learn everything I knew about watches while sitting at that desk.
Well, you also had the challenge of working with the two guys in the balcony and the Muppets, Adam and Harris. I mean,
And then Craig after that.
Oh my God, guy. Yeah. I mean,
so
yeah.
I mean, like I said, like, I basically had to learn watches on the job, and also had to keep stuff in order and had to make sure that customers were taken care of. So it was, I will say that after about a year doing that job, it was one of the most stressful jobs I've ever had in my life.
Yeah, I could definitely see Brian's pulse on his forehead at some point. But I think the thing for you, Brian, if I mean, it probably also got you into collecting or having appreciation for higher-end watches, right?
Well, I definitely learned way more about higher-end watches. Like, up till that point, the only watches that had ever been on my wrist were a Swatch, a Mickey Mouse watch when I was a kid, probably some sort of cheap digital watch that I got from CVS, like, when I was, like, a kid. But other than that, I had never worn anything, you know, more than, like, $100-$150 watch. And I also, like, didn't really, you know, understand, you know, what makes this a $5,000 watch? What makes this a $10,000 watch, you know? And why would I spend $10,000 on something that I could spend $5,000 on, or that I could spend $135 on? So, like, learning why these brands were special were really, you know, what I was learning, and, like, just learning how to sell stuff like that.
It had to be such a weird sort of mind-numbing experience.
I mean, that's possibly one of the least punk rock jobs you can have is, you know, selling high-end materials, you know, like, but it's cool. I mean, watches are a, you know, they're a means of expression for the people that wear them. And, you know, like, I don't really begrudge anyone that wants to wear a certain thing on their wrist, which I think I'm much less of a watch snob now than maybe I was 5 years ago or 10 years ago.
Are you being snooty? Yeah, so you probably are less don't look at people the same way that you used to probably back in the day, because you have a point of reference now, right? You've been in the industry, you get it. You're affected by the bug. You own a Glasuta, like,
yeah. If you want to wear something on your wrist, whatever it is, like, that's your choice, and you're wearing it for a reason. And I think that I'm, you know, much less judgmental of why someone would wear something on their wrist, because a lot of times people just pick watches because they think that they look cool, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know, like, I'm going to say that once upon a time, if I saw you wearing a Movado, I'd probably judge you for that. And you know what? I still probably would. I'm probably much less judgmental, though, if I see you wearing something on the wrist. And I'm going to say that, yes, I have a Glashütte, and, you know, I wear that as pretty much my everyday watch.
Now,
and I love that thing.
Does it tell time simultaneously in London, Rome, and Stade?
And Paris, too.
Yeah, that's good.
But I also have a Human Time Project watch that was, you know, really cheap, and I just like the way it looks, and I wear it, and I get more comments on that watch than I do on my Glashütte, which is funny to me.
Now, do you remember what your first good watch was?
Well, depends on what we're going to say is a good watch, because my first step outside of the Swatch realm, I bought a quartz tag just so I had something to wear in the store.
Yep.
Which, you know, it's a fine watch, but it wasn't really what I wanted. But I needed to have something that I could wear in the store instead of wearing a Swatch every day.
Now, was that a Formula One? What was that, a 2000?
It was a Tag 2000 Sport black dial. It had a black and red bezel.
That's a pretty cool watch. I remember that watch. It was like, it was a pretty reasonably priced at like $595 or something like that.
No, it was, I think it retailed at about at like $1,150 or $12. Because, you know, it wasn't an F1, but it was like, it was an all steel, basically, version of the F1, sort of kind of in between the 2000 and the F1 in like style wise. But it was a 2000. Like, all stainless steel.
But it was quartz, right? It was a quartz watch. It wasn't an automatic.
It was quartz. It wasn't automatic.
So, like, do you have more appreciation now, would you say, for mechanics than for, you know, just, like, a watch that works, per se?
If I'm buying a watch, like a timepiece, I mean, I'm not going to buy a quartz watch.
Right.
I want... It's going to have to definitely be something special that's going to make me buy the watch for whatever reason it is. You know, do I want something that is, you know, low production numbers? Do I want something that, you know, has hand engraved things, or do I want something that has, you know, a special complication? Like, that's what I'm going to look for when I'm buying a watch. I mean, do I want to like the way it looks? Of course I do. Like, does it have to jump out to me? Yeah, but I also want it to be something special, which is, again, like, not to make this a commercial for Glashütte, but I bought a Glashütte because no one else has one.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to bump into someone on the street and is going to be like, chances are they're not wearing the same watch I am, you know? At the same time, you know, I'm wearing a very expensive watch.
But nobody knows.
No one knows I'm wearing an expensive watch. No one has any idea what I'm wearing. And from time to time, people look at my watch, and generally the comment I get is they look at it and they see it and they say, oh, that's a really nice watch. And, you know, I just usually, you know, say thank you, and it's done with it. But they have no idea what it is. They'll ask the brand name, and they'll be like, they have no idea what country it's from. And then I'm like, well, it's German. And they're like, oh, it doesn't sound like a German company. And that's usually what the conversation is around it. Like, they have no idea what it is.
Yeah, that's the cool thing about high-end watches, in a way that, you know, there's no point of reference for the general public because, you know, these things are so far beyond. I mean, if you see a Glashütte watch, I mean, they only make 35 to 4,500 watches a year for the world. They're all finished by hand. There's a lot of decoration. It's very straightforward and practical like German engineering is, but there's still a little bit of ornation on the movement, the decoration and all that stuff. But, like, you know, when you wear it now, like, how long have you had it?
Let's see, 2008. So I guess I'm going on 5 years with it.
That's amazing. That's really cool.
And that is actually, I didn't even dawn on me. Yeah. I've had it for a little over 5 years now, I think.
And that's a 38 millimeter watch. I mean, that's a small watch. In comparison to, I know, didn't you at one time have a Breitling Blackbird too?
Yeah, I have the Breitling Blackbird. I wore it for a while, but yeah, you know, like, tastes change in the watch industry. And also, you know, like, think about at that time when we were in the store, what we had in the store. We had Rolex, we had Breitling, you know, we had, you know, a very small IWC section.
Yep.
And like ChronoSwiss.
And ChronoSwiss Tag. Vacheron.
You know what? Did we have Vacheron in the store?
We did. We had Gerard. In Cambridge. We had Gerard Perregaux. We had ChronoSwiss.
Oh, GP, of course.
GP.
Like, yeah. But yeah, when I think of like the trends from watches in, you know, the late 90s, as opposed to the trends of watches into the, you know, mid-2000s into now. Like, when I got that Breitling, I thought it was huge.
I remember. It was huge. Because 40 millimeters at that time was massive, you know?
Yeah. Actually, I love the size of the Glashütte.
You have the Panamatic Lunar, right?
No, I have the Panel Reserve.
Okay, I had the Lunar. I remember I had the Lunar, like, back in the day when we built the new store, and it's an amazing, amazing watch. I mean, it's just so cool. And the Reserve was always cool because you could, you know, essentially it was like a fuel gauge, right, on a watch.
It's, you know, with the big date and the fuel gauge on it, the Power Reserve, and just the finish on the dial and the finish on the movement is so awesome. But I think that, you know, I have small wrists, you know. I might be 6 feet tall, but I have very small wrists. So wearing a watch that size, it fits well on my wrist. And I think me wearing anything bigger than 42 looks ridiculous.
But when you, like, for instance, like your old bandmates, or I know, you know, over the years I've sold watches to some of your friends and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, are they, you know, I'm sure you still have some of the same friends. But it's kind of weird, right, to be in a hardcore band and then be wearing such nice watches and then be fully tattooed. It's got to be weird, right? Like, when you first got into it, not now, but like when you first got into it, you must have been like, these are two separate worlds completely.
I definitely think that they're two separate worlds. You know, I think that now, because everyone I know is older, that people do have, like, tend to buy nicer things as they get older. But I also know that there's people that I know from those days that would never have anything like that. You know, it's just not what they're into.
Now, what happened, like, so you worked in Cambridge, and then I know you took like a 5-year sabbatical or something. You went back home to Cleveland, where you're from.
Yeah.
And then
I finished school and I went to grad school, and then I came back, and in that time, you know, you guys had moved, and basically I stopped in the store to talk to you guys, and you guys all just were like, well, if you want to move back, we'll give you a job.
That's cool. And you saw we went from like a single level store to a multi-level store with many, many other more brands and many, many more like accoutrements and all sorts of things. But like, you know, what did you know? How did you notice, you know, what time frame was that roughly from? You know, what year was that you were gone to the time you came back?
I came back in 2007. So yeah, it was like fall of 07 that I had come back. I mean, it was like a whole new ball game because of the fact that like the bigger store, but the brand selection, you know, there was no joke. Like the brands that were being carried and the brands that we were selling were just like at such a different level than what we were selling before, you know, and before, like if we would have had like four or five Vacheron or four or five of something in the case, we would now have a case with 20 or 30 of those things in the case.
So would you say at that time, I mean, you know, essentially we created a reason for people not to go to New York, you know, to buy their watches?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, it was definitely a destination spot for watches because you could come in and there was selection, and not only brand selection, but piece selection within the brands. And you got to talk to people that knew what they were talking about and were really into what they were doing. Although I will say that, you know, basically everyone that I've worked with in any iteration of that store were people that were passionate about what they were doing and people that knew what they were talking about.
Yeah, that's very rare that you have the cohesion amongst all the people you're working with, even to the people in the service department.
I mean, I think a huge thing that we'll say, and I mean, this doesn't really do anything for sales, but I don't know a group of people that I've ever worked with in any of those stores that, like, I used to love when it wasn't busy and we would just stand around and talk, because everyone that worked there when we weren't talking about watches was pretty intelligent, could hold a conversation, and was into stuff besides watches and could talk about it. And I think that's one of the things, is everyone that we've worked with there can talk about stuff, like can have a conversation and can talk about just about anything. And they're just like awesome people to work with.
Would you say it's changed from that point to now?
I think it depends on where you go. I think that a lot of places you go into, it's like, oh, you have to be closing. You have to make your number. I think other places you go, you don't necessarily, you know, they definitely have to make their number, but it's like, I think it's the same sort of business model that we were used to working with. I don't want to just sell you one watch. I want to create a relationship, and I want to sell you 10 watches. I want to sell you 15 watches, you know, like, and I'm probably a weird shopper because I know what I want and I want to go in and I pretty much know what I'm looking for and I don't need you to sell me. Like, and when I'm ready, I'm going to buy. And if you pressure me too much, I'm probably going to leave. At the same time, I've been on the other side of the counter and I know that you have to close. So it's kind of a weird dichotomy, and it's almost to the point that if I go in to buy something, I have to tell the salesman, look, I'm going to buy something, but you need to let me do it on my time frame, you know, or I'll be like, you can go help someone else. I'll be right here. So I think that, you know, that whole idea that we want to create relationships, we don't just want to sell you one watch. I love that feeling because I love talking to people and finding out what they really want and putting them in the right thing, which, I mean, I guess that's what you get to do now because of the position you have, you know, that you're creating relationships.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, you know, I have to say from the big boss, from when we were working, you know, in retail, I mean, it was very evident, I think, from that time period, even that was really the MO. It was about creating relationships. And I think there are very few stores I've seen. I mean, I've been all over the world and, you know, I've been through a bit of a tough time in the last 6 years, to say the least, but who hasn't? Now being on the other side where I'm not behind a counter and I'm kind of like, you know, a luxury timepiece concierge and I'm doing my own thing, it's more evident now more than ever that it's about relationships.
Yeah, and I think that's a great thing.
Now, what do you think about, like what are the brands you look out for now that you're more sort of watch savvy and tech savvy and so on and so forth? Like, what brands kind of inspire you now when you look at them? You're like, that's pretty cool. I could see myself owning one.
I mean, there's certain watches that I'm always kind of going to want. And it's more like I pretty much have, you know, pretty classic taste, I guess, in my style and also in the watches that I like. Like, At some point in my life, I'm going to own a Reverso. Like, I know that it's going to happen. Definitely. Like, I want a Reverso. I've always wanted one, you know. And so, like, the Heritage Reversos that you see, like, those are amazing.
The 1931, the tribute to 1931.
Such a beautiful watch.
Absolutely.
And why is it beautiful? Because there's nothing going on with it. It's just a black dial with some nice markers, and that's it.
And two hands. And two hands. Yeah. And no, I mean, that's the weird thing, man. Like, I went from having, like, all these watches, like, everything you can imagine, you know, what I used to have. And
yeah.
And now I have one watch with two hands, no second hand, no date. I guess the older I get, the more classic I get. And I don't know if I know you've always had classic taste, but do you kind of feel the same? Like, you like it a little bit more simple than you did before, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, I do need to wear a chronograph. I wore a chronograph for how many years and probably never turned the chronograph on. Like, but some I like the look of a chronograph dial. And that doesn't mean I'm not going to wear one. One of my things, and whenever I go into watch stores and I look at stuff, and if someone's with me or if I know the salesman and I'm like, oh, I really like this. They're like, yeah, of course you like it. It's a silver dial watch, like a stainless steel silver dial watch. It's like, how many silver dial watches can I own? Like, I have to break out of that. I have to break out of that mold eventually. Like I have to really find a black dial watch that I really like because – you know, I can't really buy silver dial watches for the rest of my life. So, you know what? If I can get that 1931 Reverso, then that's what I should get because it's a black dial and it's a beautiful watch and it's, you know, it's what I've always wanted. You know, like I've always wanted an Explorer 1 even though I know it's way too small.
Right.
But it's like, it's such like a perfect watch. And then, like, the idea behind it, like, while it might not be exactly the same as what Hillary wore when he climbed Everest, you know, the Explorer is what climbed Everest. That's kind of awesome.
So that's really cool, man. I like, and again, you also, like me, like stuff that has heritage and history and a story behind it, too.
Well, I mean, I am a historian. I am a history teacher. So, like, that was one of the things that I always thought was my connection with customers is I don't know how many times, whether I was talking about the watch brand we were looking at or just talking to them, I talked about history with customers probably more than anything else. Whether, like, you know, they would ask me, you know, what do you do, like this and that, and I would be like, well, you know, I went to school for history, and they would be like, oh, I love history, and then we, you know, that's an in I have. I can talk about history, or oh, you love history? Well, here's a watch brand that's been around since whatever year, and you know, this is what they've been doing since then, and that's a great in and a great thing to talk about with someone
now,
if they're interested.
Is there anyone in particular that, you know, through your years in retail that you worked with that you could say, like, wow, this person not only knows their stuff, but they're able to relay the passion and the enthusiasm to the customer? Is there any person that you are like, holy, wow, that's amazing?
I mean, I think that we both worked with quite a few of those people.
Yeah.
I mean, I think like, I mean, aside from you, like, because you definitely do that, and you can talk to anyone. Like, I mean, that's just sort of, like, since I've known you, like, you can talk to anyone and have a conversation with them, and just, like, it's like you start talking to them, and, like, all of a sudden, it's like you've known them forever.
I appreciate it.
I think, you know, the great one, even though he would go on and on forever talking eventually, was Marty. Like, I loved hearing Marty
he
talk.
He talked his way out of a sale.
He might talk his way out of a sale, but he definitely knew
passionate.
What he was talking about.
Yes, he did. He did.
He loved what he was talking about. And that, you know, that was another one. I loved being in the store with him because you start talking to Marty and, you know, he's fun to talk to. He's a fun guy. And
he'd count on his fingers, remember, like a little kid?
Oh, yeah.
And what about, like, other brands, Brian, like when you look at brands like, you know, Panerai or, you know, brands like that, that have kind of and IWC, for that matter. Like, I look at Panerai. I mean, you know, we were one of the first companies in the country to have it. You know, obviously, you know, that was my baby, but, you know, seeing the evolution of it and also seeing the evolution of IWC, like, what do you think of these brands today? I mean, you know, like, you kind of had an intro into those brands when they launched in the US, but what do you think about them now?
I can't believe how popular IWC is in this country. And, you know, they totally deserve it, and I love their watches. And, you know, I think when I'm, you know, to the point that I'm ready to make, like, my next, like, big watch purchase, IWC is pretty high on that list. I love their pieces. I like the simplicity. I also, and you know this, I love the connection to Boston that the company has. So it's like sort of kind of full circle. If you'll remember that when I first started working in the watch store, when I came from Swatch and I was like looking through watch magazines and trying to learn stuff, I saw Panerai and I was like, I want a Panerai. And at that point in time, you couldn't really get them in the States.
No.
And, you know, like that, I was high on that list for the longest time. And then I kind of like, I was like, well, you know, I'm never going to get one. And I kind of put it out of my mind. And then, you know, next thing I know, you know, I come back to Boston and you guys are just like, you know, Panerai Kings. So, you know, like, it's kind of hard to say that a watch company that doesn't make a lot of watches is, like, super overexposed. But I think Panerai, I know you love Panerai, and I know that, like, but I don't think that I would get a Panerai now. I think that I would go for something else because even though it's still highly limited and they're hard to get, I think that a Panerai is a watch that a lot of people have. And I know a lot of people that have them, and they love them, and I love their watches, but I don't think it's for me anymore.
That's cool. That's fair enough. I think, you know, tastes change, people change, people evolve, you know, things get more exposure. Believe me, Panerai has, I think, gone back to their DNA in the last few years. I think they definitely got lost. I like that they're making now an entirely new collection of watches called the 1940s collection, which is basically a 47mm 1950 without the half crescent moon or the device protecting the crown. What I love about Panerai is you can see Rolex DNA all over it because it's the only company Rolex ever worked with. So that to me is very intriguing. But, you know, I look at that brand and then I look at other brands and I'm like, what the hell is going on? Like, I look at like Richard Mille and Romain Jerome and all these super, super ridiculously high end watches that, you know, belong on like Zoolander. I mean, it's like, I can't justify wearing a $500,000 tourbillon on the tennis court. You know what I mean? Like, I don't get
that. Yeah. I mean, I think that, and that goes back to, you know, I have classic tastes. So, you know, a company like Lange, their watches are incredible. And, you know, they're not going to do something that outlandish.
No.
So, you know, that, I mean, but that's also where my taste goes forth. I also think that, you know, eventually, and I think I think you're starting to see it, but, you know, all these companies were like, well, we have to make our watches bigger. When you see Rolex changing their case size, you know that it's something that, like, watches have to get bigger. And as a guy with small wrists, I'm never going to be able to wear something, like I said, above 42 millimeters. It just looks too big on me. So some of those watches, I just look at them and I'm like, it looks ridiculous on my wrist.
So let me ask you this then, like, you know, I know you kind of still follow watches here and there. I mean, I know it's, you know, you're not in the business anymore, but you still definitely take a look. Mm-hmm. What do you think of, like, you know, Tudor coming back to the United States?
That is, besides the fact that it's amazing that they're coming back finally and, like, in that price point, but the things that they're bringing back are so beautiful.
Absolutely.
Like, I'm just excited to go into stores and see them. I think if Tudor can keep their DNA and stay in that $3,000 to $5,000 price point and make a quality watch, which you know they're going to do, and, like, keep making that exciting stuff, the sky's the limit for that company.
Absolutely. I'm glad you said that. I mean, it's, you know, they're making their version of the Submariner, you know, which is, it's called the Pelagos, and it's in titanium, and it has a ceramic bezel with a date at 42 millimeters for $4,125. That's less than half the price of a stainless steel Submariner today.
Which also, how crazy is it that a stainless steel sub is that expensive now?
I mean, do you remember when you and I were selling them? They were $4,000.
$4,000, no date, $4,500 with the date.
Yeah, $4,475, remember? I mean,
yeah.
oh my God. And I mean, it's just crazy how things have evolved. But, you know, also this leads me to my next thing to you, which is I'm sure you've realized over the last few years, you know, the watch brands, instead of opening more retailers, are closing down retailers in favor of going vertical and building their own stores and in terms of building their own boutiques. I mean, what do you think about that?
I mean, there's good and there's bad. I think that, you know, the brands, no one's going to sell the brand better than the brand themselves. But I think that, you know, the idea of going to a store where, like, we worked and, you know, someone comes in, they're like, this is what I'm looking for. And you give them three choices from three different companies that are basically the same watch. You know, they're getting an education on different watches and they're making a decision, as opposed to someone, unless I was like, I really want an IWC, or like, I really want an IWC Portuguese, and I go into an IWC store and be like, this is what I want, and I'm just going to buy the IWC. But if I'm kind of on the fence, like, do I want to go to five different places to look at watches?
No.
So, I mean, there's good and there's bad with it. But I think, you know, if they want to control their product and sell it themselves, you know, they're going to do a great job with it, because the companies that are doing it are going to do a great job with it no matter what. But I personally, as a shopper, would want more selection.
I'm with you. I think that's a really good point. I mean, I think the only one who's doing it from any of, as you know, there's only three or four major luxury houses that own all these brands.
True.
The only one who's doing it, and I think who's doing it well, is the Swatch Group, because they own, like, the Tourbillon Boutiques that houses Jacques Aydreau and Blancpain and Breguet and Omega and Swatch, and now Harry Winston they just bought for $1 billion, out of which $250 million was debt. I mean, that's just incredible when you see the evolution, considering we couldn't even give away Omega when we were selling them, right?
I mean, you know, Omega definitely have their watches that are, you know, like, the Moonwatch is always going to be, you know, a great watch. And, you know, when the Planet Oceans came out, like, those were great. But, like, you know, I mean, Omega is a certain type of watch, you know, and a certain type of person. It's crazy to think how that brand's evolved.
And what do you think, though, about, like, you know, I mean, listen, now that we're on the subject of Omega, I mean, they've always been, you know, heavy with endorsing celebrities, from Cindy Crawford back in the day to the evolution to the food chain. I think they were really the first ones to really do it and do it well. But, I mean, what do you think now about all these brands like IWC and the brands that you and I, like, grew up loving together doing sort of the same thing? I mean, do you feel, because, like, I know, like, we used to talk about these things all the time. Like, IWC used to be that watch for that real gearhead that, you know, maybe had a $5,000 bike in titanium and didn't want anything, like, flashy, and wanted something understated and something really gearheaded. But now it's sort of like, you know, you see all these celebrities at SIHH and you see all these, like, different collaborations that are happening. What do you think of those things now? I mean, I get it that brands have to evolve, but I don't know. For me, IWC, I think we were one of the first in the United States to carry them when, you know, there were only two people answering the phones at IWC, and there were two ladies, and they sounded like they were smoking cigarettes and drinking bourbon at 9 in the morning. Like, what do you think of those brands now that we circle back to where they are at their evolutionary state? What do you think of that now?
You know what? I think that part of it is that people in general, and that includes celebrities, had no idea what those things were. So if you look at, if you're going to, you know, blame anyone for that, if there's anyone to blame, it would be stylists, because stylists are putting these watches on people, or, you know, the people are being like, oh, I want a watch. Because back in the day, what did celebrities wear? They wore Rolexes.
Yeah.
Or maybe a Vacheron or something, an old brand like that.
Right.
You know, so isn't Louis C.K. wearing a gold IWC chronograph these days?
Yeah, he is.
You remember, so Louis C.K., before he put out his own TV special, when he put that out himself for $5, he was wearing a Submariner, and he always wore a Submariner on stage, and he would even talk about, like, this is the nicest thing I've ever bought for myself, a steel sub.
Right.
And now he's wearing a solid gold IWC chronograph. So I think that celebrities are more into it now. So back in the day when people like Tag and Omega and those companies and Rolex were sponsoring people, it's because those were the watches they were familiar with. But I think as the public as a whole has become more educated and has wanted different timepieces than everyone else had, celebrities are also on that trend, and that's why you see people wearing these watches now. Well, you know, whether stylists put them on their wrists or they're like, I want something different. And so if they're going to wear them, it makes total sense for the companies to be like, hey, if you're wearing this, do you want to take some money and be our spokesman?
No, I mean, I'm all about that. I guess it's a really fine line that you have to tote between being exclusive and having this like worldwide phenomenon. You know?
Well, here's the thing. If you put your watch, and I'm just going to keep using Louis C.K. as an example, but if you put your watch on Louis C.K.'s wrist, a lot of people know who he is. Now, how many watches a year does IWC make?
I mean, I want to say it's under 100,000 pieces for the year for the world.
Okay, so are they going to increase their production because are people going to buy a watch because Louis C.K. is wearing that? You know, like, I don't want to see I don't care that if someone is the face of IWC or someone is the face of Watch Brand X, but if it's one of these smaller companies that's only putting out a limited number of watches a year, I don't want to see them increase numbers.
What you just said is very important. I'm glad you brought that up. That is when you lose your momentum and your steam. When Tudor comes out, if they're at every Rolex dealer, what's going to make them special? Nothing. You know, the fact that they're not being put in every Rolex dealer and they're only going to be in 100 dealers in the United States, that to me is sexy. That to me means that they're going to be able to hold on to their longevity. It's cool. When you start creating this, like, everybody's got to have it and it's like, you know, it's like a hysteria like the Beatles or anything else, then to me it kind of like you lose the true essence of what you're trying to achieve.
Because wasn't it back in the day that if you wanted Rolex, they would give you Tudor, and if you could sell Tudor, they might give you Rolex?
Yeah, that it was. It was used as a bargaining chip, you know what I mean, for Rolex. Absolutely. But now they're kind of going the other way because they saw, wait a second, Tudor didn't really work out for us 20 years ago. Now we're going to do it differently. We're going to use Tudor as a way of saying, and we're not. And for those people who want Tudor, if they mention Rolex, we're not going to give them Tudor because we want to treat them totally differently. So I think it's very smart.
Yeah, I think that's going to do way better for Tudor. I mean, but you know what? Also, I mean, how many doors has Rolex closed too? You know, Rolex needs to make themselves exclusive-er as well.
Well, I mean, I don't know how much more exclusive you can get when they make close to a million pieces a year, but I hear what you're saying. I think that Rolex, the problem with Rolex is that it's like its own currency, right? I mean, you know this as well as I do. There's no we can dog Rolex, we can piss on Rolex all we want, but there is no brand who's been able to attain what Rolex has been able to attain with making the numbers they make and being able to hold the value the way they hold their value.
Oh, I would never say anything bad about Rolex. You know, they are the greatest mass produced watch in the world.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and they keep their cachet. You know, you would think that at some point people would be like, no, that's not really for me. But, like, Rolex is Rolex, and Rolex is always going to be Rolex. So, well, they have to do things to make themselves seem special. And, you know, some of the design choices they've made in the past couple of years I might not agree with, but they apparently know what they're doing. And I'm just some guy, you know, talking about watches right now.
You're that guy.
Yeah.
No, I understand. And what about like do you think like there should be like a return to like intro luxury? Like, do you like the fact that, you know, all these little brands are popping up in the intro luxury market, like Alpina and all these different smaller brands that are kind of like trying to make, you know, a more expensive looking watch but being very realistic about the price? Are you cool with that?
Yeah, I mean, give everyone, you know, a chance. Like, again, you know, not everyone can afford a $10,000 watch.
Yep.
You know?
Absolutely.
And not everyone, you know, can not only can not everyone afford a $10,000 watch, but it goes back to what I said before, where if someone wants to put something on a wrist because they think it looks cool or they like it for whatever reason they like it, I'm not going to begrudge them for it. And if they like that watch and there's someone who's going to be there to fill that niche for them, then that's awesome. You know, like, and I love to see smaller brands and I love to see, you know, smaller startups because they're going to take care of their customers. You know, they're going to be the people that are making less watches and, you know, paying attention and try to be a certain part of the market. And if they can fit, then good for them. Like, they obviously have a business idea that they want to work with.
Do you feel that, you know, these stores, like if you don't have friends that work in the industry and you go into the stores, do you feel like, have you ever been to a store where you don't know someone's working in a watch store or a boutique?
And yeah, of course.
And do you feel like, you know, do you feel like the knowledge has gotten more or has it gotten less? And do you feel that, okay, even though with the advent of the internet and now everybody's an expert and everybody has access to this information, do you think that this sort of information is causing people to be more unforgiving to those people who may or may not come into the store and may have an attitude?
That's kind of complicated. I think, like, you know, I don't know if I'm the person to judge that all the time because I go, you know, if I go into a store and, you know, it's not a store I'm familiar with or it's a store that, you know, I don't know anyone that's working there and I just kind of want to poke around and look, you know, like I'm obviously more educated than your average customer. You know, I think that, you know, that's kind of a trend, I guess, in sales all over the place, is I think people are looking at stuff online. And, you know, and it's the same thing still that, like, you know, people find prices online. And then they go into stores and, you know, people want to make sales. And, it, you know, there's that push and pull where, like, well, I saw this price online. And then the person behind the counter is like, well, you know, trying to explain that. And it's, you know, it's a tricky scenario for them.
I don't think there's anything more annoying, though. I mean, and you know, I mean, I basically have dedicated my entire life to this business where I see, like, you know, these people who, you know, may have like a master's degree in science or teaching or whatever. And all of a sudden now they're watch bloggers and I mean, that's fine. I that's awesome. I think that's the beauty about being in this country and having a blog is that anyone can do anything. But at the same time, for those people who are starting these things, there's no point of reference.
No, and I think that, you know what, we don't even have to be talking about watches. There are bloggers that are great. And there are bloggers that are awful because people are like, oh, well, I can just write anything online. But they don't know anything about the subject they're talking about, or they don't know anything about, like, journalistic ideas. And, you know, they just think that they can write anything online. So, I mean, it's not just blogging.
Yeah, no, I totally understand. I mean, I guess that's what infuriates me is that, you know, I just had one of the big brands who I can't really mention call me and say, hey, there's a, you know, we're trying to sell this guy a watch. He's ready to wire us the money. We're ready to sell him the watch. And then he reads this, you know, online thing about, you know, some blogger who's working for one of these big fashion companies that has an editorial watch section, and they're slamming the brand left, right, and center. He's in the store. He's ready to pay for it. He's ready to walk out, and he reads this thing, and he's like, you know what? I'm not going to buy it. And so the watch company is like irate. You know, like, anyone can just write anything, and it's going to be used as gospel.
Well, at the same time, I would say that, you know, just because a blogger can write something on the internet, people have to be smarter and realize that not everything you read on the internet is true.
Yeah.
You know, like, and it goes back to the people that are reading these things. And this is, so I guess this is the big question or the big takeaway from this is, how do you educate your customers to know how to read these things on the internet?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, if you have a customer that's going online and he's reading something that someone says, like, consider the source.
Well, that's part of the reason I wanted to start this, you know, luxury concierge business, because I feel like there's not enough people out there who have credible information, and they may read a story and it's their interpretation, but it may not necessarily be the truth.
I guess what the thing is for you is that you're not affiliated with any brand. You're not affiliated with any store.
Nope.
So you're not, like, you're going to sell something because the person wants it. It's not like you're beholden to any company or any storefront or anything like that. Your goal is to educate people and get them in the right watch for them.
Well, that's why I think it's, you know, in a way, I think this sort of business I'm doing now is pioneering, because I don't think the thing is, I don't have a store. I don't have to get rid of inventory. I don't have a staff. I don't have overhead. I'm pulling from many different inventory sources, and I'm going to sell you what I think is best for you. You know, there's not that pressure on me to close a sale because I have it in my stock. You know, whereas I think a lot of people do, you know, they do care. A lot of the brands do request these dealers to make heavy investments in these brands. And, you know, that's why they're stuck up. I mean, you know how many watches we used to have in our inventory. I mean, it's crazy. You're not the demand is not outweighing the supply by any means. You know, you have an education you have to give these to. And I think it's very important that you go to people who do have experience within the industry. And not just some guy that, oh, I want to get into the watch business. I have nothing against that. I think that's wonderful. There's always, hey, I learned somehow. You learned somehow. I mean, I'll never stop people from learning. But in terms of taking people's words seriously, I think you need, like you said, to consider the source. I'll leave you with this. I remember one of the people we used to work with in our store, and I won't mention the name, but this person... I remember trying, you know, a lot of the employees would listen to my spiel because, you know, I had spiels for every brand and it worked. I used to sell a lot. And the funny part is I would tell this person or I would say to people, you should never shower with a Rolex. It will break the seal, the water resistant seals. And
yeah.
This person interpreted it like, you'd never want to take it in the shower. It will melt the gaskets. So it's amazing interpretation. But Brian, thank you so much for your time today. And I look forward to catching up with you soon in the future, man.
Awesome. Great talking to you.
Thanks, buddy. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, there you have it, people. That was my one-on-one interview with good friend Brian Ristow, former bassist of the group 10 Yard Fight, history teacher, watch enthusiast, and he's very experienced, man. It was great talking to him. We worked together for a long time. He has an amazing perspective and understands how things work. So thank you, Brian. I'd also like to thank Shallowboy Music and DJ Flipside for providing the musical tracks to this podcast. If you want to know what's going on with me and the watch industry, you can check out my Instagram, my Twitter, my Facebook. You can also log on to my website, www.amitdevhonda.com, where you can check out my bio, my pictures, my podcasts, my videos, and much, much more. You can also sign up and get my weekly newsletter delivered straight to your inbox every week. And until we meet again, rock on and fly back.